From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The VA scandal. Thousands of veterans died. Whistleblowers asked Tammy Duckworth for help again.
I think the reaction Congresswoman Duckworth had was one of avoidance and denial.
Mark Kirk lied repeatedly about facing enemy fire and serving in combat.
Where to begin with Jennifer Bertino Tarrant? Start with the money. Mike Madigan's funneled $200,000 to her campaign.
Susana Mendoza spent her political career following Mike Madigan's orders.
I second the nomination of Michael J. Madigan for Speaker of the Illinois House of Representatives.
Anti-abortion lobbyist McConkie wants to ban every abortion, even in cases of rape, incest, and life of the mother.
Ruling class Kate Clunan thinks you're dumb. Ruling class Kate thinks you don't know the difference between federal and state government.
Bruce Rauner and the Illinois Republicans support a man for president who insults women.
I'd look her right in that fat, ugly face.
I will support the Republican Party's nominee.
If Bruce Rauner and the Illinois Republicans support Donald Trump after all that, why would we support them?
Well, just a few days until it's all over. Election day. Can it get here soon enough with all the negative ads we've been hearing? We're going to talk more about that today. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel for State Week includes Charlie Wheeler. Charlie is director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. And Brian Mackey, IPR reporter. And our guest today, Mike Riopel, State House reporter for the Daily Herald newspaper. Mike, good to have you on once again.
Thanks, Sean.
I mean, I'm going to start with you, Mike. It has sure seemed like a long election cycle, at least to me. Maybe that's because the fighting we've heard among Democrats and Republicans in Illinois during the legislative session has just carried over into some of those ads like the ones we heard.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And in this long budget stalemate, there were ads during that budget stalemate where there were mailers with each side tacking each other and each side saying these mailers are not doing a lot to help the climate in Springfield. And they've just continued. They've amplified. We saw numbers the other day that so far there have been 16 legislative races hit over the $2 million in spending mark. That is a pretty remarkable number. And you know, we'll see who comes out on top in November, but I guess more to the point, how that plays out in the months afterwards. I mean, that's a pretty toxic environment to take back to the Capitol, and I can't imagine it'll be sunshine and rainbows after that.
Brian, you've been covering the negative ads and looking a little closer into those. Is there any evidence to say that this is the most negative campaign Illinois has ever seen, you know, top to bottom across the state, or is this just, you know, what we've become more accustomed to?
Yeah, I'm not sure that you could quantify it, but I do think in terms of the negativity as a, you know, word count or anything like that, but I do think the money has been pretty widely acknowledged that it's unprecedented, largely because Governor Bruce Rauner has managed to inject so much and a few of his very wealthy allies new money into the Republican Party. And the Democrats have, you know, and labor unions have worked extra hard to match it. And they've been fairly well balanced between the two of them. But as Mike pointed out, there's double digit races now, you know, that have exceeded the, you know, $2 million mark, a number of exceeded the $4 million mark. That's remarkable. I mean, there are some states in which entire U.S. Senate campaigns are not necessarily as expensive as some of the state legislative campaigns, where you think about it, these people are running to represent, you know, in urban areas, as the case of a few square miles, you know, a few tens of thousands of people. This is not, you know, a campaign for governor or anything like that. These are very small individual races, but this aggregation of money has been really remarkable.
And also, it seems to me that some of these ads have been even more over the top than normal. Now, and I could be wrong about that, because we've certainly seen some wild accusations thrown about in past years. But, you know, is there any evidence to show that maybe more liberties are being taken with the truth on some of these?
You know, and it's I don't even know that it's so much liberties with the truth. It's just certainly very selective storytelling is done. We've seen on the Republican side, they've really gone out of their way to tie as many Democrats as possible to House Speaker Michael Madigan, whose approval numbers we saw in assignment poll were below 20%. Even in Chicago, he's not a very popular figure, which is his hometown. And as Charlie has pointed out in the past, you know, protecting Chicago has been one of his core legislative priorities over the decades. And likewise with Democrats attacking Republicans, we've seen them all tying them to Donald Trump. And, you know, in terms of the negativity this campaign cycle, negativity works. That's why politicians use these ads. And there are even arguments out there. There's a political scientist a couple of years ago came out with a book. I might mangle the title slightly, but it was basically the positive case for negative campaigning or negative advertising. And his position is that, you know, if politicians are only doing these sort of soft focus morning in America, aren't I great? Voters are not really going to be well informed. And that if you actually talk, if you say to voters, do you like negative ads? Of course, they're going to say no. But if, you know, voters, if you ask them, well, do you want to know more about candidates? And oftentimes the, you know, television ads, for better and worse, are one of the main ways that people learn about politicians. Negative ads can actually increase what voters know about where politicians stand. Now, is it, you know, if it's saying where somebody stands on abortion or gun rights, that's a little more informational. If you're just saying that they like to hang out with sex offenders, which is one of the themes we've seen this year, then I'm not sure how much that's actually informing anyone.
Yeah, Sean, I'm not sure if it's better or worse than years past. In part, I'll admit I don't vote in primaries, so I don't think that I actually get a lot of the ads that some people have been receiving in their mailboxes. Some people do pass those on to me, and it's pretty incredible. For example, I know in the Quad Cities, I mean, those mailboxes have to be ready to topple over from the sheer weight of all of the campaign brochures that they've been receiving. Some stretches of the truth, I think. There have been Republicans tying Democratic candidates to convicted child pornography trafficker viewer, former Representative Keith Farnum, saying that they've accepted money from him when really it was, you know, just all filtered through Democratic money. It's not like they are saying that they're sticking by him. He's in prison. Many of the people that are running for office that have been subject to those brochures probably never even met Representative Farnum, because he was gone from the legislature when they even were solicited to be candidates in this election. But we've seen a pattern of that working. There have been a lot of ads also hitting Republicans for voting against a variety of social services that I think most people would support, be it domestic violence, shelters, what have you. And part of that is that Republicans throughout this budget impasse voted against budgets that they said were out of balance. Again, it's not like you had Republican legislators saying, no, I don't believe in that cause, but maybe you could, I guess, parse out. Some people would say that wasn't how it went down. Others would say, in effect, by not voting for that budget, you allow one to not get in place, and it did result in those cuts, so it's fair and deserved. But I do think that there's just been a lot of stretches. And then truly, of course, what has happened more recently with State Representative Avery Born, who's running against Democrat Mike Mathis in an attempt to keep her seat just outside of Springfield, where it did not, we believe, come from the party itself, or at least from Mike Mathis himself has denounced this postcard that was mailed out in envelopes that I have not actually seen it, but
apparently a photoshopped image of the of a mm-hmm. lewd photo there with Avery Born. Yeah, Charlie, let me bring you in real quick because
mm-hmm. And we should emphasize seemingly a fake photo.
Yeah,
fake.
Her face was photoshopped, pasted on Photoshop yeah. type of thing, and like I said, that doesn't necessarily that maybe go beyond some of the stuff we've seen so far. And it, again, no tie that we've been able to determine at this point that has anything to do with her opponent or the party, the Democratic Party, in that sense. But Charlie, something Brian had mentioned earlier was the idea that, you know, some people believe that the negative ads serve a purpose. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. Well, let me back up. They serve a purpose in terms of trying to trash your opponent and make people not wanting to vote for whoever the target of the negative ads is. Do they inform people? I suppose if you look at information as being the accumulation of data, yeah, they do. But if the data is erroneous, is misconstrued, is twisted out of reality, is it better to have that kind of data or not? I recall years ago, an aide to one prominent official telling me the problem isn't what he doesn't know, it's what he knows that's wrong. And I think that's what happens with voters. It becomes neither of these candidates, based on the advertising I've got, they both should be locked up for a long time, so I have to make the choice of which one is the least evil. And I don't think that that serves us well at all. But as was noted already, I suppose it must work. I mean, it repulses me. But on the other hand, I've been closer to the process, so I probably have a better sense of what's going on than someone who doesn't watch this stuff for a living. And I think it contributes to an overall degradation, overall coarseness of our politics, and contributes to the notion that public service is somehow tainted. And I've wondered to myself, how many people who could contribute a lot look at this arena and say, I just don't want to get involved. The price I would have to pay personally is too great for me to devote my time and energy for the good of society.
You know, if you ever tour the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, they have a display, or at least they did at one point, on negative advertising, and it shows you that goes way back. I mean, even before Lincoln, but they have many things that were being said about Lincoln at that time, so he was being hit hard. But is there just something different about it today? I mean, in that sense, from what we've seen in the past? Well, I don't know but maybe there is.
Well, I'm pretty sure nobody was tweeting horrible stuff about Abraham Lincoln. Nobody was spreading it out on Facebook. Nobody was spreading it out on social media.
So it was more. It permeated more. It permeated.
Well, it's instantaneous.
Maybe
too.
It is, but I was amplified.
I would push back a little, though, on the notion that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were saying really terrible things about each other, and they would spot. You know, I think some great newspapers were founded in order to attack other founding fathers back in the day. And, you know, there's certainly the rumors about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, which we now know are facts, but, you know, at the time were just suggestions. I mean, I think there's always been a really
when those rumors came out, and let's say the rumors were launched, and I don't remember my history, I'll have to plead ignorance on that. But let's say they were launched in New England. How long do you think it was before someone in Georgia heard those rumors? You know, it wasn't nanoseconds, right?
No, that's true. I mean, you definitely have an echo chamber effect nowadays that's with the instantaneous communication that's a little different.
And a lasting record, probably,
sure,
as well. That, you know, right now you can Google somebody and whatever you look up in an individual now that has had that on their record and any brochure, that's an immediate Google versus, all right, fade into obscurity into an article that was not easy to pass around.
And, of course, the fake news. News articles, too, that, you know, by fake news organizations. Go ahead,
Mike.
We've
even seen the reemergence of some, you know, an old school way of doing things. I mean, Dan Proft, who runs the Liberty Principles PAC, which supports Republican candidates, one of the things he started doing, even in the primary, was he created at least 8, I think there might be more now, newspapers that get mailed out to a lot of people and carry stories about his favored candidate. So there's both that amplification via technology and cash and TV, but there's even that kind of return to that what you guys even mentioned earlier.
Mike, I'm going to keep it up at the Capitol there. You and Amanda, you work with lawmakers, covering them on a regular basis. You get to know them. And Mike, you said something earlier is whether or not you felt as though after the election, if this just breeds a lot of mistrust among the parties, you know, the whole idea that everybody after an election can come together and work in a bipartisan manner, that it's hurt by some of these ads. Do you both think that in general that the legislature has just too thin of a skin to be able to put these things in the past?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to imagine for me that after the election is over, everything, then we'll finally see some movement on the budget that's been stalled for so long. If you remember, we heard that about the primary election. Oh, once we get past the primary or past candidate filing deadline, maybe we'll see some movement because we're past those important dates. Well, didn't exactly happen that way. And there's people would predict, well, we get past this election, we get a new General Assembly in there, you know, we'll we'll see some movement now. And you know, whether it's because of all the negative advertising or just a change in the dynamic based on who's here, who's still here, who isn't here, who's new, I don't know. It's hard to imagine there just being a flood of productivity after the election.
Right. And I'm not sure how much of that really results from these ads and the nasty nature of campaigning as much as it will be, presumably, unless we see a very big shift in the balance of power or something, Governor Rauner, quote unquote, folding and giving up on his agenda, or the Democrats laying off in their opposition to it. There are certainly going to be some hard feelings. I do think that you have individuals that have thin skins, but then at the other hand, you have plenty of, I think, people that understand that this is politics. That's how it goes. You're in campaign mode. Then you get back here. And there are plenty of friendships, relationships, collegiality across the aisle. But I think that you do see, for example, when Rauner made comments about the Democratic leadership, in particular Speaker Madigan. We saw, for example, at the end of one session when he called out both Madigan and Senate President John Cullerton for their law firms, businesses, and ties, and called into question the ethics of that. I think there was a sense that they were that. The leadership kind of punished Rauner, that the attempts to work together. I mean, you're not going to hear oftentimes legislators saying that because they all say, we work together. We all want a budget. But yeah, behind the scenes, I think that there are some of those comments that have a lasting effect. And there is, and that has been clear when you've heard Madigan say, quote, that's not helpful.
Yeah, and I would just amplify what Amanda's saying. I don't think it's necessarily about thin skins. A lot of people, as Charlie pointed out, if you are willing to suffer the slings and arrows of what it takes to be a politician in 2016, you've probably figured out a way to compartmentalize people accusing you of consorting with sex offenders and that sort of thing and move on with your life and hold your head up still. I think that the bigger question here is that what is the end game? And I think what we've seen is that this, rather, you know, the governor came in talking about how he wanted to support Democrats who would go along with his turnaround agenda. And in fact, it's just made everybody more polarized. Democrats are running into the arms of Speaker Madigan and Senate President Cullerton. And, you know, I think one of the inflection points here was the end of 2014. He was still governor-elect Bruce Rauner at the point. Remember in his victory speech, he talked about how he tried to call Speaker Madigan and Senate President Cullerton and didn't actually get through. But, you know, the message that did get through is that he parked $20 million of his own and a couple of his allies' money in his campaign fund when he wasn't up for election for four more years. And I think that Democrats took that as a sort of a sign of war. And I think we've seen Illinois governance go accordingly in the years that have followed that.
Well, I think the governor's rhetoric hasn't helped at all in terms of being able to reach some compromise. In that there have been occasions in the past, frequently, with Republican governors and Democratic leadership, Michael Madigan, Phil Rock, when Phil Rock was Senate president, where they would disagree with the governor. But there was no public personal animosity. Now, the governors, Thompson and Edgar, might have thought that Madigan was a jerk or a crook. Madigan might have thought the same of them, but nobody said it in public. And to me, that's the difference. It's if I'm going to negotiate a deal with Sean Crawford, I don't tell folks I think Crawford should be in jail, but I'm going to sit down and work out this deal. I may think it internally, but if I'm smart, I'm not going to say that and sour the relationship. And it's like these days, it's not enough for me to win. You also have to lose. And back in my days as a reporter, it was, let's find a way where we each get something to move the process forward.
I hope Charlie keeps his thoughts about me to himself, but I'm going to move
that's
on.
All
here.
Hypothetical.
I'm going to move on here to a race we talked about last week, but it was the U.S. Senate race. Mark Kirk, the Republican incumbent, and facing the Democratic Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth. They had a debate in Springfield just before we taped the show last week, in which Kirk basically, I think by all accounts, and even his own, made a misstep during that debate trying to mock the military heritage of Duckworth's family. And afterward, he did apologize, and I think we mentioned that on last week's show. But Amanda, you spoke with Senator Kirk this week. He did apologize. Did he try to explain away what was going on there in his mind when he made that comment?
I wanted to make the interview when I spoke with him not just about that comment, because as we did speak about on the show, there was plenty else in the debate and clearly plenty more that would be an issue for whoever wins that U.S. Senate seat. And yet, you have to ask about it, and really did want to give the senator an opportunity to perhaps clarify or explain what was going through his mind at the time. What he really, the big takeaway was, you know, I apologized, she accepted, let's move on. He didn't seem to really want to talk about it all that much, and then said what it was really a failed attempt at snark. He says that's what it was meant as, and that he has a long history, a tendency to perhaps be too quick in opening his mouth and saying a comment before thinking it through. And given, of course, I think some voters' questions and a Chicago Tribune editorial that some people found earnest, others found offensive, that basically said the newspaper was going with his opponent, Tammy Duckworth, instead of Kirk, because they didn't feel like he was up to his job following his 2012 stroke, asked Kirk, you know, is this a medical issue? Has this propensity to make comments that are seen as salacious, offensive, is that something that is a result of, you know, some sort of medical problem? And he said, you know, I had that problem before the stroke. He didn't call it necessarily a problem, but he did say that it was a tendency. So that was really the takeaway from it. He said that he was disappointed that a couple of groups, that was something we did not talk about last week, it did occur over the weekend, the gay rights organization, the Human Rights Campaign, and also former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, her gun control group, had both endorsed Kirk over Duckworth, which was seen as a big deal, given that he's a Republican. And that was what Kirk said. He said they tend to go for Democrats, and that's what they're doing. He called it disappointing and wanted to really make clear that he believes he has a strong record when it comes to both gun control and standing up for LGBTQ rights.
Hey, Brian, I know you've been following this race, and you have some thoughts on what may decide this race as well. And it wouldn't just be this one incident during a debate.
No, I think that what's going to decide this race is the overarching dynamics of Illinois being a decidedly blue state. I mean, Kirk has had an uphill climb here for a long time. He won that seat in the Tea Party wave year, and he won it pretty closely. It's not like he won it decisively, it was decisive. It wasn't a contested election or anything, but it wasn't a huge margin that he won in 2010. That was a midterm election. It was a Republican wave year. That was the big Tea Party year. And now he's running in a presidential election year, which tends to favor Democrats in Illinois. It's a very blue state because he has taken a lot of moderate positions that do in some ways make him more attractive to middle of the road voters or even Democrats. He's alienated a lot of members of the Republican Party faithful and he also is distancing himself from Trump. He was one of the first national Republicans to unendorse Trump and call for him to drop out of the race. We've heard from rank-and-file Republicans who say, well, if you're not going to support our party's nominee, we're not going to support you. So I think he's had a very challenging time, and a lot of the polling seems to suggest that he's been struggling for much of this race now.
You know, and he was considered to be, again, one of the more susceptible Republicans to being defeated during this election campaign. Mike Riopelle, is anything about this race surprised you when you look back at it?
Not exactly. I agree with Brian. I mean, the die was kind of cast in demographics, you know, at the beginning, and that's what he had to overcome. In 2010, he did. Because not everybody could. I mean, Bill Brady lost that election in 2010 at the top of the ticket, despite that Tea Party wave, but Mark Kirk was able to win statewide in 2010. But yeah, coming into 2016, that demographic challenge was always going to be the biggest one. And what would the debates look like? What, you know, these comments haven't helped him. I think he would agree with that. But I agree with Brian that the dynamics of the race, I mean, look at everything that's come up that he's had to, you know, explain. You know, when Justice Scalia died and Mitch McConnell said immediately, you know, that the Republicans weren't going to have a hearing on him, Kirk made a big deal out of the fact that he would meet with Obama's pick, Merrick Garland. So he's had a few instances like that, like with Trump, where he's had to split with his party, things that have angered Republicans, but also don't help him with Democrats.
Yeah, and if I could just add sure. on one, I mean, this idea that Mike's pointing out about, you know, how Senator Kirk has had to respond to things that Mitch McConnell says, and he's been asked about things that Trump says, and he has, you know, maybe had less of that than a lot of other Republicans because he did divorce himself from Trump so early. But I think that that's one reason that despite all the spending and all the effort that's going into this campaign this year, it's going to be something that is going to it's going to be hard to draw conclusions about the direction of Illinois. You're going to hear a lot of spin after Election Day about, well, the voters have spoken and they don't want Mike Madigan's way of governing anymore. The voters have spoken. They don't want Bruce Rauner's way of governing anymore. But a lot of political scientists I've talked to have said that, one, there's going to be a lot of dissertations written about 2016. And two, because of the Trump factor, you're almost going to need to put an asterisk next to every sort of political conclusion you try to draw out of 2016. When you study it, you'll have to have a separate variable called the 2016 variable, just because Donald Trump's position at the top of the Republican ticket is just such a unusual, perhaps we'll find out in 4 years, but perhaps one time sort of unusual event.
All right. Time now for our notes from the field. Amanda, let me start with you.
Let's see. So we had a case. There's been a lot, of course, in this election cycle, questions about whether there will be voting irregularities. We had a case of something a little odd in Rock Island, where a series of ballot requests never actually made it. So that is something that we are continuing to see the outfold of. There is Dan Proft, as Mike had mentioned earlier, his organization, one of the PACs involved with that. And we do have U.S. Senator Dick Durbin now calling for a true investigation and wanting the U.S. attorney to weigh in.
Charlie Wheeler.
Well, next week, not only will be the election, it will also mark the 1 year anniversary of legal medical marijuana sales in Illinois. And there was a report that came out this week saying that retailers, and this is from the state, retailers sold $4.1 million in marijuana during the month of October, made another month of increasing sales, and the sales have totaled almost $28 million since legal marijuana sales for medical purposes began a year ago.
All right, that will do it for today. Members of our broadcast include Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Vinicky, Brian Mackey, and Mike Riopel with the Daily Herald. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org. You can also find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. The production assistance for our program today provided by Brian Mackey. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.